there's a reason you aren't satisfied with the ordinary. You were made for adventure. A life with God doesn't have to be boring. It can be a pulse-pumping, heart-pounding life of purpose. And we can guide you there. The adventure awaiting you is bigger and more life-giving than you could ever imagine. Join us every weekend for 45 minutes of challenge, hope, and encouragement to guide you on your spiritual adventure.
Hey, welcome to Crossroads. Thanks for joining us today. Whether it's your first time, a thousandth time, yeah. it doesn't really matter. We're just excited that you're with us today. My name is Kyle. I'm the community pastor for Crossroads Church Online.
And I'm Hannah, and I produce experiences here at Crossroads. And
today, we're starting a brand new series that I think is critical and we're really excited about.
And this series is exciting, and it's called, Who Was Jesus? Really?
Which is a question that we have to ask.
We have to ask.
Because there's so many different answers out there. Depending on who you ask, yes. It could be like one thing or the complete
opposite.
Opposite of it.
Absolutely. And so we're going to be answering that question by looking at what Jesus did and what he said throughout this entire series. We're going to be going back to the source. So to kick us off, we're going to catch up with our teaching pastor, Chuck Mingo.
Hi, I'm Chuck Mingo, teaching pastor at Crossroads, and I want to be a good person. I think we all want to be a good person. Now, I'm also a Christian, and one of the things that teaches me is that I can't be good enough, and that's why I need Jesus. I need a relationship with this guy, Jesus, who we're going to be talking about today, who somehow was good enough. And he was good enough because he was able to follow this thing called the law. What does all of that have to do with us? Well, that's what I want to know more about. And so today we're going to connect with an expert, someone who's an expert on the Jewish law. And we're going to try to understand what was it that Jesus could do that we can't do that's made all the difference for us. Well, I'm here with Rabbi Karen Tomashow, who is an associate rabbi and an expert on the law. Certainly better an expert than I am. And Karen, just want to talk about first, just talk about the relationship of Jewish people to the law, to the Torah.
Absolutely. So when we discuss Jewish law, we obviously need to begin in the Torah and the 613 laws that we see there. Some of those laws are about how to practice holidays, how to practice rituals and sacrifices. And others of those laws are about our ethical and humane practice towards other human beings. There also are legal implications of behaviors that are poor. We start in the Torah, and then we go to the first centuries of the Common Era, where the rabbis take the laws from the Torah and they say, gee, what exactly did they mean there? Or how would they be relevant to today's modern world? That happens from the first few centuries of the Common Era to today. We still have rabbis and poskim, legal experts, who take these laws, some ancient, some derived from the ancient, and then say, how do we interpret them even more today? I'll give you an example of something I've been thinking about recently. Here we have a pandemic. And we have a number of laws about using electricity or not using electricity on the Sabbath or on holidays. Well, how are you supposed to gather with other people when you're obligated to have a group of people to get together for certain holidays and practice them? What do you do when you have a Seder on Passover, for example? There are rabbis who actually looked at these questions in the last number of months and said, gee, okay, yes, you can, for the purposes only of gathering, expend this energy, or no, you can't. And so here we have maybe one other example would be something like fertility or infertility. We know more today. We have more science advances, but there are a number of questions that need to be asked about what can you do, what can't you do to bring about human life.
That's really interesting. And so what you're saying, though, is that the law isn't this one-time thing that was interpreted, but it's ongoing. There's an ongoing relationship.
Absolutely.
With the Jewish law.
Yes, we would actually say that revelation or being the law being revealed to us by God initially, but over these years, is something that is absolutely ongoing. We never say that it ends in the Torah. It just begins there.
That's really interesting. So given the importance of the Jewish law, how do you expose children to it in particular? I mean, this is such an important aspect of what it means to be Jewish. So how are children introduced to this?
Formally, the rabbis of the first centuries of the Common Era said at the age of 5, you begin to learn Torah. Makes sense if you think it through. They can start to read, they can start to reason, they can start to understand a little bit between right and wrong. They're learning stories, and there's so many stories in the Torah. And yet, they're not obligated by the law. It's not something that they are beholden to. So if they make certain mistakes, it's actually a given. And that's probably the best process of any learning.
Interesting.
By the age of 13, you are bar, son, bat, daughter, b'nai, children of mitzvah, of the commandments of our tradition.
Talk about the preparation before someone becomes bar or bat mitzvah.
Yes, first of all, our children are going to religious school and taking on those studies, lots of Jewish learning and intentional learning and practice, lots of praying a few times a day, perhaps, or at least once a week, and learning that Hebrew, which is really fundamental. You know, if you read laws in English in Judaism, they're going to be already an interpretation of the original Hebrew. So understanding some of the nuance of the language and what that means. But it's also about doing the deeds of the commandments that also strengthen our community. So it's about visiting the sick. It's about spending time with the elderly. It's about giving of yourself, right? Again, that stage for our 13-year-olds when it's all about me, I think the Jewish law helps pull them out of all about me when a law is very often a legal obligation that you have to others. And so we help our children prepare both knowledge-wise, intellectually, and physically, emotionally, spiritually, if you will, but also kind of that responsibility. We call it the age of responsibility. And so then when they're coming before their congregations by reading Torah, it's marking that moment in time. It's not actually about just reading from that Torah or saying blessings. It's actually about acknowledging or designating this is a community that I, as a young person, am taking my place as a part of and I can be counted on.
Yeah. What comes to mind when you think about maybe some personal experiences where your relationship to God has been influenced by the law? How has this played out for you personally?
As a liberal Jew, one of the things that I'm thinking about as you ask me this question is here I am, a female and a rabbi, and I am obligated by the same laws, according to my theology, that men are obligated by. And so it's extremely meaningful to me as a rabbi to fulfill so many laws on a regular basis because it's also part of my profession. For example, we have a number of people right now who are extremely isolated and lonely, and we are supposed to take care of our fellow, right? And so... here, both as an individual Jew, but also as a rabbi, we're checking in on people. We just created a new program for congregant care to say, okay, how can other members of our community check in on other members of our community and all fulfill these mitzvot or these laws and commandments together? That brings me closer to God. This is a challenging time where it feels like we're throwing spaghetti at the wall sometimes, and we have to be so safe and so careful, and that leads to isolation and loneliness and sadness. And I feel like, you know, I don't believe that personally, my theology is not that God brought this about or that God's just going to randomly take it away either. But I do believe that God is with us during challenging times. And God has given us so many incredible abilities to use in this world. And even coming up with a vaccine is fulfilling this amazing commandment in the Torah, in my opinion, that says, if you lose property, you need to return it to your neighbor. Hmm. Well, what is that about? Probably it was the same goat or ox.
Right.
I've been talking about a lot of animals today.
Right.
But the truth is that it was expanded many years later to say, wait a second, that's someone's health. If you're a doctor and you can help someone who lost their health find it and give it back to that person, you need to return that lost property. I don't see that as any different than what we're doing right this moment. And that to me is connected to God and each other and a profound responsibility.
And that is a powerful example. I had never thought about that in that way. And you're kind of hinting at this, but you know, the law and the relationship to the law isn't ultimately about the law. It's about what does this say about our relationship with God and each other. What would you say about that? What do you think the law, why do you think this is the way God structured it and designed it in Jewish culture to be this way in this relationship to the law?
Yeah, so the example that I really like to give is about the sacrifices in the Torah. Because they're so irrelevant to us today, but yet their essence of what they meant is so relevant to us. So we had all of these laws about these sacrifices, both animal and vegetarian, and they were ways in which to also take care of guilt and other transgression and also show our gratitude and praise toward God. And the word in Hebrew for sacrifice is korban, which means lekarev, to come close, right? And we're not coming close to the meat or the wheat. We're coming close to God. And many years later, after the temple period, right, we had sacrifices through that period. Right. And then we had no central synagogue. And we ended up having many different houses of worship. And prayers emerged as the sacrifice of our hearts. And so that's how we got close to God as well, is through prayer. For many, it's in a formal service. In other cases, it's at home when you're praying or talking to God or whatnot. Mm-hmm. But that, to me, is a great example of how those laws were designed as a means toward the end of connecting with spirituality, with God, with the sense of holiness.
Wow, that is so good and so helpful and clarifying. And so one of the things I want to go back to as maybe a final thought is, but there's 613 of these, right? So I think we would agree no one can perfectly keep them. And so What do you see as the remedy for that? How do you deal with the fact that we've been, you know, given this law that none of us can fully keep? How do you think about that from a Jewish perspective today? Or how did, you know, what's the historical evolution of how that was considered?
That's great. So I'm thinking actually of the teaching in our tradition that says you are not obligated to finish the work, neither are you free to desist from it. Now, that's very much related to social action and justice. And we can get overwhelmed and say there are so many problems in the world, like, I'm not even going to try to get involved. But that's not appropriate. We are never free to walk away from any challenges. The same goes, I think, for the law. You may not be able to follow them all or even understand them all, but you're not free to walk away from that responsibility, in my opinion, if you are a part of the Jewish tradition. And so, for example, I would say that out of 613, there are a ton of laws about agriculture. For most people, that's not going to be relevant unless you're living in modern Israel and you have a kibbutz or a farm or whatnot. That's fine. The same goes for a number of laws that are really irrelevant because we actually think they were never enacted in the first place, like stoning a child. My God, we would never think that that was something that would happen. It was probably more of a deterrence for poor behavior. And to take actually someone's behavior seriously when our children are calling out for help or something like that. But then there is also this idea in Judaism that we learn and we learn and we learn. And in Orthodoxy, we learn and then we follow the laws to the letter as much as we can. And in liberal Judaism, we learn and then we do what we call ethical monotheism. We still believe in one God. We still have these laws. But we ethically choose which ones fit for this time period and this moment. And so as long as you're studying them and becoming knowledgeable, then you fulfill them. We study them in order to do them. And I think that there's no way that anyone could fulfill all 613. I don't think the Torah imagined we'd fulfill all of them. It actually is much later when Maimonides gives a number to all of them that we actually know how many there are. But think of something like pru or vu. The first law in the entire Torah is to be fruitful and multiply. And that's so beautiful and so meaningful and something that people who have families like to do very often. But then there are some people who can't have children. And should they be excluded from that law? Absolutely not. Maybe they also choose not to have children. So then perhaps they're doing other things to be fruitful in this world, to have an impact on the next generation. That is so powerful. And that is also an example of how we see the law is something that we enact, even in its interpretation, if you will. I think that anything that we do in this world has to have meaning. And at the same time, we can't understand everything behind all of the laws. And so I think where they're not going to cause harm, actually we're taught you cannot die by the commandments. Like you cannot follow them in order to have a poor outcome. That's not okay. Or you can't do justice unjustly. That would be terrible. So there are times and moments where they do not all apply. But again, we're not free to desist from trying to understand the role of law in our lives today.
Wow. I just want to say thank you. I think that there's so much to glean and learn about our relationship with God based on what you shared about your relationship and the relationship of Jewish people to the law. So thank you so much.
My pleasure.
In Matthew 5:17, Jesus says, "Do not think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I've not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. For truly I say to you, until heaven and earth pass away, not an iota, not a dot will pass from the law until all is accomplished." Jesus fulfilled the law. You could say he kept all the rules. Now, I said before, I want to be a good person. I'm a religious person. You could call me that. But what we realize, even as we think about what Rabbi Karen just told us, religious traditions and observances really are useless unless they point us back to God and his love for us. And no one knew that more than Jesus, even though Jesus was the only human ever to fulfill the law of God. But if we can understand what his fulfillment means for us, it'll make us love God even more. I mean, think about it, 613 commandments. It's impossible to keep all of them, but wouldn't you think that was the point? The point is perfection, right? That's why the law is there. And so there we are again in this whole thing of trying to be good. But what we want to dig into is there something deeper going on with this idea of keeping the rules? Jesus was the only person who kept them perfectly, but why does that matter? And what does that have to do with me or with you? Well, it has a lot to do with what is the biggest problem we face, which is that we can't keep all the rules. And yet God and being with God requires perfection. We see this in the New Testament in Romans chapter 3 in verse 23, where it says, "For all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God." This is going to be coming to you in January of 2021, a year probably unlike many other years where you're making some New Year's resolutions. I know I'm making some New Year's resolutions. Maybe some of those resolutions are like, I would love to not have to wear this thing all year long, whatever it may be. But here's the thing. No matter what resolutions I've made, I miss the mark. There's some years where I might crush it. There's some years where I might nail it. But I can tell you, more often than not, I don't live up to even my own expectations of who I want to be and what I want to do. You know why? Because I'm a sinful person. And that idea of sin means that we have a total inability to keep the law. We can't even keep our own law. We can't even do the things we say are important all the time. But because God needs total perfection, this issue of sin becomes a big problem for us because there's no in between. God is perfect. We are not, but to be with God requires perfection. And so we find ourselves maybe getting into a debate of degrees. And here's the thing, there is a big difference between us and God. Such a big difference that even if we're just slightly off the mark, that makes a huge difference in our lives and in our relationship with God. I heard someone talk about this in terms of flying a plane, and they said 1 degree of difference makes all the difference in the world. They said on a flight from JFK to LAX, that 1 degree might put you 40 miles out in the Pacific Ocean. That's right, 1 degree off could be the difference between making it to an important meeting in LA on time or using your seat as a flotation device. And that's what we're facing. We face the challenge of being off by 1 degree. And I see this all the time in my life. You know what? I love being married and I want to do what's right, but I can get obsessed with being right in my marriage instead of being relational. You know, I love my kids, but if I'm raising obedient kids, but doing it in a way that when they get older, they can't wait to leave my home, that's a problem. I'm a pastor. But if I'm doing holy work for God that actually causes my kids to resent me and God, that 1 degree off is a big, big problem. See, here's the thing. You can be sincere and you can be sincerely wrong. And that's our problem with sin, is that our intentions really don't matter. We either hit the mark or we don't. And what sin says is we all miss the mark. So what are our prospects? Well, we really only have two. We can either try harder or we can try something else. So let's just think about trying harder for a bit. Does that actually work? To try harder, to be better, to be a good person, those New Year's resolutions kind of mindsets. Well, I think about a story in Jesus' life that illustrates maybe one of the challenges of trying harder. What happens when you fail and you know that you failed? Jesus had an interaction with a woman who was caught in the act of adultery. Now, this is an interesting story in the Bible because obviously it takes two people to do the act of adultery, but she's the only person who's called out for this. Story for another time. But after looking at all these people who were accusing her, Jesus actually says to them, whoever is without sin, whoever has not missed the mark, cast the first stone. And then one by one, and I love it, it says, starting with the older men and then the younger, they all dropped their stones and walked away. Why? Because they all knew they didn't meet the mark either. But I love what Jesus says to this woman after this. He says to her, woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you? And she says, no one, Lord. And Jesus says this, neither do I condemn you. Go, and from now on, sin no more. See, what Jesus understood is this woman was living in shame, and shame is what happens if you adopt the try harder approach. If you think that ultimately you're going to do better than you're doing right now on your own power and in your own way, you're just setting yourself up for failure, and you're setting yourself up to be racked with shame. I know what that's like. I've lived in that kind of shame. But then there's another story that illustrates maybe the alternative side of trying harder and why it also doesn't work. Jesus had an interaction with a rich young ruler. This is a guy who was successful. This is a guy who was crushing it. According to the culture, he had the money, he had the power, he had the prestige, and he was even a righteous guy. He was a law-abiding citizen. And he comes to Jesus and he says, Jesus, what must I do? What do I have to do to get eternal life? And Jesus goes through all these commandments, and it's like, you know, the Ten Commandments. And the guy's like, Jesus, I've kept all of those since I was a boy. And I don't think he was necessarily bragging, but this is a guy who looked at his life and said, hey, I am following on this path. But look at what Jesus says to him next. Jesus says to him, you lack one thing. Go, sell all that you have and give it to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven, and come, follow me. And it says that the man was disheartened by the saying, and he went away sorrowful because he had great possessions. See, on the one hand, we find this woman who was racked with shame. But on the other hand, we see a guy here who really is believing a little bit too much of his own hype. He's struggling with pride. And so here's the deal. If you think that trying harder is going to help you have a better relationship with God, it's going to lead you to two places, and neither of them will lead to better relationship with God. You will either try harder and be racked by shame, or you will try harder and you will have a religious pride. And here's the thing, both of those paths will leave you far away from God. And guess what? Right here, right now, you're making one of those two choices. You're either trying harder, or maybe you've decided you want to try something else. So I want to show you Jesus's mic drop moment, a moment that happened in a space very much like the space that we're in right now, where Jesus's practice was on the Sabbath day, which would have been the day when people gathered. They'd come and they'd be at a place where people would read. They'd read from the scrolls of the Bible, the Old Testament, that law, the Torah that we talked about in the temple. And Jesus on this day stands up, which was a sign that as a rabbi, as a teacher, he wanted to address the crowd. And Jesus does that, says that they gave him the scroll. And the scroll that he was given that day was the book of Isaiah, an Old Testament book that's full of all kinds of prophecies about this person, this Messiah, this rescuer that God was promising. And it says that Jesus looked at the part of the scroll that would have been Isaiah 61, and he starts to quote it. This is what he says. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim liberty to the captives and recovering of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed and proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. And it says that he rolled up the scroll and gave it back to the attendant and sat down. And the eyes of all in the synagogue were fixed on him. And he began to say to them, today, this scripture has been fulfilled in your hearing. Drop the mic. drop the mic. What was Jesus saying? Let me tell you what he was saying. Jesus was saying this. Hey, you remember this scripture from Isaiah that says that because you can't keep the law, you need to depend on something else. You need to try something different. Jesus says, I have been empowered by God to be the different that you need. To preach good news. And to preach good news to who? Jesus says, I'm preaching good news to the poor. And while that certainly meant people who were economically poor, Jesus was also saying people who are poor and humble in their hope for God, people who recognize that they can't keep the law on their own and have a healthy spiritual poverty. Jesus said, I'm preaching good news to you. He says, I'm coming to proclaim freedom for the prisoners. And certainly, again, every time the word freedom here is used, it always means forgiveness of sin in this book. And Jesus is saying, I am coming to forgive sin. He says, not only that, I'm actually coming to recover sight for the blind. See, there's another sense in which what Jesus was saying here is, if you're trying harder, you're spiritually blind. You're blinded by pride or you're blinded by your shame. And I have come to give you your sight back. I've come, Jesus says, to release the oppressed, people who are beat down, who feel like there are just too many rules. I can't do it. I can't measure up. And Jesus says, if that's you, I've come to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. What Jesus was talking about there was this Old Testament idea of Jubilee, that every 50 years, every person in the country had all of their debts paid off. You got any debt? You got any debt? You got a mortgage? You got a car loan, you got student loans. Can you imagine if right now someone just said all of your debt has been erased? Jesus was saying, I am the way that happens for you spiritually. I am the remedy for all of the ways that you can't keep the law. I am the remedy that helps you to get off of the try harder track. And here's what I know, it's a mic drop moment, because listen to what happens next. It says, and all spoke well of him and marveled at the gracious words that were coming from his mouth. And they said, is this not Joseph's son? So yeah, there are people that were marveling, like, oh man, that would be awesome. Oh my gosh, if you're the Messiah, if you're the long-awaited one, how good is that news? But then there are other people like, who do you think you are? I know your parents. Like, there's even a rumor story about your dad not being your real dad. Like, what? You? See, some people marveled at what Jesus said, but other people mumbled. And actually, later on, we find out some people wanted to murder him. But I want you to marvel at this. And I want you to understand that God does not intend for you to try harder. That what Jesus was announcing in this moment is marvelous news, because it means there's an alternative to the futility of trying harder. We don't have to just try harder. That is not the way we get to relationship with God. There's a better way. There's a beautiful way. There's someone who has come to be a different way. Romans chapter 3, verse 21 puts it this way. It says, but now the righteousness of God has been manifested apart from the law. Okay, so it's not about keeping these 613 rules anymore. Well, then what's the way? What's the way? Let's keep reading. Although the law and the prophets bear witness to it, meaning they point to this. They pointed to the need for this. It says the righteousness of God has come through faith in Jesus Christ for all who believe. For there is no distinction, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. Remember that verse from earlier? We talked about that. Here it is in context. You know what it's saying? We all missed the mark. God knew we would miss the mark. And so what did God do? He made another way. And it says, and are justified by his grace as a gift through the redemption that is in Christ Jesus, whom God put forward as a propitiation by his blood, to be received by faith. Propitiation. What in the world does that mean? What it means is this. Propitiation is the remedy for our shortcoming. It's the remedy for our falling short. The propitiation that first was prescribed is what we heard the rabbi talk about. It was the sacrifice of animals. Then the propitiation, as she said, is now modernly seen as like these prayers from our heart. But what Jesus says is, no, I am the final and ultimate propitiation. I am the final and ultimate means by which you get forgiven for everywhere you fall short and for which you can be reconciled into relationship with God. 2 Corinthians 5:21 says, "For our sake, he, God, made him, Jesus, to be sin who knew no sin, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God." I like how this is worded in a paraphrase of the Bible called The Message. God put the wrong on him who never did anything wrong, so we could be put right with God. Let me ask you a question. What's the most generous act anyone has ever done for you? Think about that for a second. I will tell you, I don't have to think very long. I've had a lot of people do kind things for me, but for sure, the most generous act anyone has ever done for me on this planet, besides what Jesus has done, has been my mom's decision to give birth to me. March 31st, 1976. My mom was 39 years old. My dad was 47. They thought they were done having kids. And it actually was a little bit dangerous for my mom to be pregnant that old in her life back in the 70s. And the doctor gave her an alternate choice. He said, "Hey, if you don't want this pregnancy, we can help you with that." And my mom said, she told the doctor, "If God impregnated me with this child, then God wants me to have this child." And so I just know there is nothing that anyone has done that is more generous than my mom's choice to give me life, to be the vessel through which my life could come. And I'm telling you what, Jesus did that for you. Jesus came and he kept all the rules so that you could have life, so that you could be forgiven, so that you could have a life with God. It is the most generous thing that anyone has ever done for anyone on the planet, even more so than my mom. Because while my mom was able to help me experience physical life, Jesus is helping you and I, through his perfection, through the substitute that he is for us, experience life, not just now, but forever with God. It's the greatest gift you can ever receive.
You know, that gift that Chuck was talking about, it should compel us. That gift of grace, it compels us and it moves us to acting in worship and in gratitude and even in giving.
Right now, we're going to hear someone's story from our own community who felt compelled to give this discipline of giving a shot. Check out what happened.
I'm married with 3 kids, and I am a third shift supervisor at a hospital that I've worked at for 25 years. So I was raised in this area, and I grew up in a Baptist church. My parents, they never tithed. When I would see them give an offering, it was always when the offering plate was passed, they would, you know, give $20 here and there. We stopped going to that church, and there was a time in my life where I was not in church, but I knew I wanted to be, and I wasn't sure where I wanted to go, or what church I wanted to call my home. And my daughter brought a flyer to me from the Florence Crossroads. They were opening up and she wanted to try it. So I told her yes. So we came here. I wasn't very sure about it at first because the music was different. Wasn't sure I could get used to the screens and the media. So after we left the first time I came to Crossroads, wasn't sure about it, and I told her, I said, "Well, we'll keep coming back and try, and I'll see." And before I knew it, 8 years had passed, and Crossroads grew on me, and I really liked their mission as far as, you know, not only bringing God to people, but also the works that they were doing within the community and in other countries. Just trying to make the world a better place, and I knew that that was something that I wanted to be a part of and I wanted in my life. So when I came to Crossroads, they definitely promote tithing, which is something that I had never done. Whenever it was time to, you know, give money, I would just give the $20 here or there, you know, whatever I felt. They also were promoting the 90-day tithe test. And what that is you sign up and it's more or less like a contract online and you agree to give 10% of your income for 90 days. After the 90 days, if it didn't work out for you, then they will give you your money back. So listening to the test and the details of it and just what Brian was saying in his message, and I thought, well, there's no time like now. It's something that I could feel God was calling me to do. With everything that God has always done for me, I knew that it was time for me to start giving back to Him. So I signed up online for the tithing test. It was very easy. I had it set up to where the money is deducted from my check before I even see it. When the test ended, it was not a problem. I always had the money. God always gave me the money I needed for any other finances and bills I had. And the 90 days came quickly. After I took the 90-day tithe test and realized that I had surpassed the 90 days, I kind of sat and thought, for one, wow, that was fast. And second of all, I really had to thank God for not only allowing me to be able to tithe, because financially was not a struggle. And then also I just realized, with me wanting to find a renewed purpose in my job, that also happened. And over the 90 days, with God showing me the different ways that I could implement things within my workplace and my shift and with my employees, over 90 days, definitely the third shift at my hospital has become a place where I can tell people are happier to be there. They're also coming to work with a renewed sense of purpose. All of that put together, I'm just so thankful that God showed me the way to tithe and to also find a new purpose within my work. So if anyone is thinking about taking the tithe test, or you're getting that call to do it like I was, I would say definitely try it. And it was very easy to do. So I would recommend it for anyone who's feeling that calling from God.
You can join Angie and take that challenge yourself. Go to crossroads.net/give to learn more. And when you do that, it's an act of worship, which is what we're gonna do right now with music.
And if you like what you hear in that music, you can search us on Spotify or wherever you get your music by searching Crossroads Music.
was his own.
Love the chance to help you in any way that you need help. This is a church and we're here to care for you. One way you can do that right now is go to our website, crossroads.net, click the chat button, and it's a real actual person, not a robot, will meet you, talk to you, help you. However, you can also email me. This is my actual email address right here, kyle.ranson@crossroads.net. Do my best to get back to you within 24 hours.
Or you can email me.
Yeah,
that's right.
That
correct.
Could be better,
my email
actually.
Is down here as well, and it's hannah.shepherd@crossroads.net. The point is, you can email either one of us, but we want to care for you. You know what? Throughout this entire month of January, we've been running after this guy named Jesus. Who is he really? What is he all about? And one of the ways we're seeking to answer that question is by engaging in weekly services. And the reason we do that is because we need hope. We need inspiration. Yes. We need to be grounded
in
truth.
Every single week.
Every single week.
Super helpful.
Life is hard. And one of the ways we can do that, if you want to know more about that or get involved with that, you can text HABIT to 31313. We'll see you next week.